The following program is made possible with support from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Twameva Mata cha Pita Twameva Twameva Bandhu cha Sakha Twameva Twameva Vidya Dravinam Twameva Twameva Sarvam Mama Deva Deva.
India has always incorporated, not absorbed, but incorporated parts of other civilization and kept them as a part of herself.
It was not her wide open spaces that eluded me, or even her diversity, but some depth of soul which I could not fathom, though I had occasional and tantalizing glimpses of it. She was like some ancient palimpsest, on which layer upon layer of thought and reverie had been inscribed, and yet no succeeding layer had completely hidden or erased what had been written previously.
Passages to India, a series created by Julian Crandall Hollick. India is a very old civilization that has absorbed and transformed many other civilizations into something new and uniquely Indian. First came the Aryans, then the Muslims, and finally the British. Each made its impact, each was absorbed, and each then became a part of India. Our program is called Biryani and Plum Pudding.
Tanna's a remarkably pretty little village, snuggled up against the first hills of the Himalayas in the Doon Valley. You reach Tanna across a riverbed. At this time of year, it's bone-dry earth and rock. But in the rainy season, it becomes a half-mile-wide flood, runoff from the hills and valleys that lie beyond. If you follow one of these stone irrigation channels, happily gurgling with water, up through the lychee groves, you come to the temple of the local goddess, Bala Sundria Mata. Her shrine sits over there on a cliff, jutting out into the valley floor. To get to it, you have to climb up more than 60 steps, cut into the cliff face. Today's the festival of Bala Sundria Mata. Indian festivals are a hopeless jumble of the sacred and the very profane. I think a village festival should always be cheerful and noisy, something you can hear in the fields the other side of the valley. Something that makes you want to leave the fields and come and just have a good time. At the base of the shrine, several hastily erected stalls selling vegetable pakoras and sweets made from boiled milk covered with a wafer of beaten silver, spicy puff rice and fluted pema cornets, and the first lychees of the season from the village groves. But no mangoes yet. Lychees will do. But if you've never tasted an Alfonso mango, you've never really lived. Ah, the music's finished. Farmers sit down, clear their throats, and begin to sing bhajans to their goddess.
Bala Sundri Mata ki, Bala Sanche Darbara ki, Jai bala sundari mata jay bala sundari jay bala sundari.
There's a method in our madness. We've come here to find part of the answer to this problem. India, like the United States, has welcomed scores of different nationalities, religions, and cultures over the centuries. So far, so good. But that's where the similarity ends. In America, identities dissolved into the famous melting pot. Within a couple of generations, one ceased to be German or Polish or Lebanese and became American. In India, as usual, things happened differently. You kept your original identity and simply took on an additional one. A bit like putting on a dinner jacket over a t-shirt or a parka over a sari. In some way, you had become Indian, but you were still something else, and you and everyone else still knew you as that. So if America was a melting pot, then India's always been more like a beehive. Lots of individual cells, all self-contained, yet all sharing a common bond. That makes it infinitely elastic, able to accommodate all sorts of contradictions and opposites. Of course, it also undermines social cohesion. To understand what makes Indians tick, you have to understand how and why they can be both one thing and the other. And one of the clues is here, at the festival of Bala Sundriya Mata. One by one, the villagers climb up the steps to make offerings to the stone idol. As the pandit smears my forehead with red paste and some grains of rice, I wonder who Bala Sundriya Mata really is. At least the pandit should know.
This is a very old temple. Before that, there was no temple. There was only the stone sculpture of the goddess. And that stone sculpture is right there at the corner. Can you see?
Right down in the corner.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah? Yeah. How long has that been there?
They don't know.
But many hundreds of years?
Many hundred years.
Pandachi's only been in Tano for 2 years. He says he doesn't really know the story of Bala Sundriya, but one of the villagers does. He says originally there were 7 sisters, and their shrines now dot mountain peaks throughout the Himalayas. Surrounding Bala Sundriya in the shrine are more familiar effigies, Durga and Kali and Hanuman the monkey god. Maybe Bala Sundriya is just another form of the goddess.
They are not related. These all gods and goddesses, they work together.
I wonder, does that mean they worship them all?
Yes. It is not that they have to worship only Bala Sundari goddess. They worship every god and goddess. But they, in this village, they believe more in Bala Sundari goddess.
You see, Hindus feel no contradiction worshipping several different gods at the same time. Bala Sundriya, Kali, Shiva or Vishnu. And they extend this ecumenical spirit of tolerance to the gods of other religions. Now, Jews, Christians and Muslims have a pretty hard time even contemplating the possibility of another god. Not surprisingly, Hindus often resent this apparently rigid intolerance. Hindus tolerate any religious belief, provided it doesn't directly interfere with another. If you take that one step further, this also means that Hindus don't see any real hypocrisy in praying to gods they don't really believe in. It's merely an expression of respect for the beliefs of others. One of the most delightful and innocent practitioners of this spiritual generosity is Meenakshi. Meenakshi is in her late 20s, living in Madras in southern India. Meenakshi is, and always has been, a devout Hindu. But when she was younger, she used to go regularly to Catholic Mass.
When did you start going? That is in my early stage when I was wearing frock or something. I don't remember the year and all.
But you didn't belong to the church.
No, I didn't belong to the church. Just like that, we used to
go to the temple, and you used to go to the church, you used to go to all the same
simultaneously, time? Yeah. Every Tuesday, we used to go to that St. Anthony's Church in Paris. And then on Wednesdays, we used to attend the Novena Mass, all of us.
And then you used to go to the temple?
Oh, when? Temple also. Simultaneously, I used to go to the temple also. So I used to pray Jesus and Mother Mary as well as our gods.
But you see no contradiction or no difficulty in going to both at the same time?
No, nothing like that, because I think everything is same.
And it doesn't stop there. All are logical. How can you believe in this when you also believe in that? Leaves Indians scratching their heads. They don't see the problem. This is Dr. Sudhir Kaka, an Indian psychiatrist trained in Vienna and the United States.
We in the West would find a businessman who consulted an astrologer. We'd find something very odd about that.
I wonder why. My experience in the West is that the skepticism about things and about knowledge is much, much less than it is here. Everyone is quite skeptical about most knowledge, most progress, that since they keep on changing in any case.
There is no conflict between my faith and religious practice and my professional training and professional work, on the other hand. These two don't conflict. And I can live in peace with both these things.
Birbhadri Mishra is a scientist leading the effort to clean up the Ganges. He's also the hereditary chief priest of the Sankat Mochan Temple in Benares and officiates at all the daily services.
As a student of science, I feel that there is a vast world beyond the purview of our senses.
Let's try it another way. Can an atheist be a Hindu?
The basic thing is, everything is created by God, and God's creation cannot be without any reason.
J.B. Siddalingya is a professor of religious philosophy near Madurai in Tamil Nadu.
If you accept this as a perfect basis, there is no room for questioning anything that has been created by God. Even a communist or a non-believer has been created by God. So that is the way God would like to make these people realize what they are and what they stand for.
And there's one final clue, maybe where you'd least expect it, in India's caste system. The caste system's really a form of institutionalized inequality. It breaks society up into self-contained, segregated social units, whose mutual relations are also ritually defined. But this also means that if a new social group, such as the Aryans, the Muslims, or the British come along, provided they respect the existing customs and status quo, they're accepted as yet one more caste. It's accommodation through compartmentalization. You don't change the newcomers, just add a new cell to the beehive and let them stay as they are. Time, the quality that India has in abundance, will eventually transform them. They say that snakes shed their old skin and grow another. That's not the Indian way. Indians simply grow another layer. Jawaharlal Nehru, as so often, said it the best.
We have been an exclusive people, proud of our past and of our heritage, and trying to build walls and barriers to preserve it. Yet in spite of our race consciousness and the growing rigidity of caste, we have, like others who take pride in the purity of their racial stock, developed into a strange mixture of races.
The countryside here in western Gujarat is flat, sandy, and bone dry. The border with Pakistan is just a few miles from here. 5,000 years ago, these flat, inhospitable plains bustled with towns and small cities, part of a sophisticated urban civilization centered on the Indus Valley. Then Aryan tribes, nomads from Central Asia, came in, dribs and drabs, intermarried with the Aborigines and settled down. Then, like all settlers, they moved on east, along the rivers,
the Yamuna and the Ganga into the heart of India.
The interaction between the Aryans and the Aboriginal tribes had two great consequences. The first is Hinduism, the synthesis of the Aborigines' worship of fertility gods and the Vedic rituals of the Aryans. And the second is the caste system, the division of society into classes or varnas based on occupation and skin colour. The fair-skinned Aryans on top, the dark-skinned Aborigines at the bottom. The Muezzin calls the faithful to prayer at the Mosque of Nizamuddin in Delhi. As much a part of the Indian soundscape as film music, the cries of street vendors, or the squawk squawk of the crows. For centuries, Muslim armies raided northern India and then withdrew. But in 1526, Babur, nicknamed the Tiger, grandson of Tamerlane, descendant of Genghis Khan, invaded India for good. He captured Delhi, pushed on down the Yamuna River to Agra, and established the Mughal Empire, the rule of the Mongols. And the poor man was miserable in the hot, dry plains of northern India.
The country and towns of Hindustan are extremely ugly. All its towns and lands have a uniform look. Its gardens have no walls. The greater part of it is a level plain. Most of the natives of Hindustan are pagans. They call the pagan inhabitants of Hindustan Hindus. The people are not handsome. They have no idea of the charms of friendly society, of frankly mixing together, or of familiar intercourse.
Babur's heart yearned for the mountains, for Samarkand, Bukhara, and his capital Kabul.
They very recently brought me a single muskmelon from Kabul. While cutting it up, I felt myself affected with a strong feeling of loneliness and a sense of my exile from my native country, and I could not help shedding tears.
Mughals loved the music that water makes. Everywhere they lived, they left behind gardens built around the play of water on stone, water on water, different angles, different notes, different rhythms. Up here in the Vale of Kashmir, they built the Nishat Gardens to remind them of the mythical garden of paradise. Ghulam the boatman is singing about the sacred beard of the Prophet Muhammad, while he paddles me across the lake to Nishat. I bet for him this is probably what paradise might look like.
There's enough evidence to suggest that the Mughals did not look like, after the first few decades, a foreign power.
That's Ashish Nandi, sociologist, Bengali, and he wouldn't want me to forget, passionate lover and writer of the game of cricket.
They intermarried with Indians, they lived like Indians, and even if they've tried to retain something of their earlier lifestyle, in the process of living in India, this lifestyle changed enormously. In fact, they also influenced in something, the Indian lifestyle, and Indian lifestyle influenced them. I think their integration was more or less complete. By the time the Mughal Empire ended, I do not think any Indian identified the Mughal dynasty as a non-Indian dynasty.
That was true then, but perhaps no longer in today's India. Nation building has brought in its wake Hindu nationalism. Just how much Indian Muslims are or are not part of India are burning ideological issues that can explode in the most innocent setting. It's quite clear that Islam in India, is very different from Islam almost anywhere else in the world.
Among the Muslims, from the birth to the death, all the customs and the conventions and the rituals, you will find they are borrowed from the Indian society. They are not the heritage of the Arabic or the Iranian Islam.
Waris Alvi lives and teaches English in Ahmedabad in Gujarat. Waris is a Muslim and a passionate defender of the contribution Islam has made to Indian culture.
The Muslims, by and large, who are not fanatically fundamentalist or religious, of that culture we are very fond. The culture in which the elements of Hindu and the Muslim cultures and religion and thought are common. And that culture has given us the Urdu language, which has always been the language of poetry and beauty and communal harmony.
I'm skeptical about the common claim that Muslims fundamentally altered the lifestyle of Hindus. It looks a bit lopsided. It's clear that India's Muslims are heavily Hinduized. They think and act like Hindus in almost every respect. But I don't think the reverse is true. It's hard to find much Islamic influence in the lives of most Hindus, especially in the countryside. In religion, it's pretty much one-way traffic.
By and large, the popular Islam in India is very much Indian, while the popular religion in India, the popular Hindu religion in India is very much Hindu, with less influences of Islam.
Many of the Muslim rituals practiced in India have little in common with Arab Islam. They're modified Hindu practices. Orthodox Islam is monotheistic and bans all worship of idols. Try telling that to an Indian Muslim. Just like Hindus, the Muslims worship saints or holy men as manifestations of God's spirit. In West Bengal, the only way they could explain Muhammad to the average villager was if they told them the story of Krishna and substituted Muhammad for Krishna. Nobody seemed to mind or consider it blasphemous. And even today, there are Hindu temples in West Bengal where some of the priests are Muslims.
Brahminism has been so strong that they have always undermined these things. And that is why the influences have been cut down. And we see the resurgence of the Hindu society without much of the Islamic influences on it.
The obvious exceptions are food, dress, painting, and of course music.
As far as the Indian culture goes, I think the most important thing the Muslim influence has been in the field of music.
Dr. Sheikh Mohammed Zakir is a surgeon working in Lucknow. Musical instruments themselves, just about every aspect of northern Indian classical music, in fact, is Islamic in style and content.
Most of the musicians of the past and even of the present, most of them are Muslims. And to keep the tradition and the culture and the music of India alive, is tremendously in the hands of the Muslims.
The Golden Temple in Amritsar, Punjab. Probably one of the most peaceful and beautiful places in the world, or was in happier times. The temple itself lies in the middle of a small lake, surrounded by a wide marble walkway and arcades where priests sleep and eat. From 5 in the morning till 10 at night, they sing hymns from the Granth Sahib, the holy book of the Sikh faith. Many Hindus dismiss Sikhism as nothing more than a variation within Hinduism. Sikhs rightly get angry. Sikhism isn't Hinduism. It isn't Islam. It's what happened when the devotional Islam of Sufi missionaries mixed with the traditions of the medieval Hindu Bhakti tradition to form something new, Sikhism. Bhakti was an attempt to return to the purity of early Hinduism, to talk directly to God without priests or other intermediaries, and to talk and sing to God in local languages and dialects, not in Sanskrit. It was populist, and it cut right across religious and caste lines.
You see, in the medieval period, they are from the lowest of the low classes. The tallest bhakti, that is, devotional singers, in the tradition of devotion, in the tradition of bhakti, during the Middle Ages, the greatest names are from workers and the so-called untouchables and backward classes.
Umashankar Joshi is from Gujarat. He's one of India's best-known poets. Umashankar is self-taught. Like most Indians, he was born in a village. But Umashankar has stayed close to his roots. He writes in the local idiom. He delights in it. Bhakti has great emotional appeal for him.
The people were the patrons. For the saints, they didn't need any patrons. Kabir, you have heard of him, 14th century. One of the tallest of mankind and a great prophetic voice. In India, from Vedas to today, he is a very tall figure, and he was a weaver. He earned his living from weaving. He didn't care for any patron.
I don't touch ink or paper. This hand never grasped a pen. The greatness of four ages, Kabir tells with his mouth alone.
Kabir was born in Benares around 1400 in a Muslim weaving family. Technically, he was illiterate, but Kabir has an extraordinary ability to see straight through the cant and mumbo-jumbo that had come to overlay much of Islam and Hinduism. And he usually gets directly to the point.
The creatures are like you, Allah Ram. Lord, be kind to them. Why bump that shaven head on the earth? Why dunk those bones in the water? Parading as a holy man, you hide yourself and slaughter. Why wash your hands and mouth? Why chant with a heart full of fraud? Why bow and bow in the mosque and trudge to Mecca to see God? Does Khuda live in the mosque? Then who lives everywhere? Is Ram in idols and holy ground? Have you looked and found him there? Hari in the east, Allah in the west, so you like to dream. Search in the heart alone. There live Ram and Karim.
How ironic and sad that this essentially peaceful faith should now be stained with the blood of sectarian violence. The Golden Temple's largely deserted these days. What was supposed to bring together now divides. That could also be a commentary on Islam's contribution to India. India had absorbed Islam and Islamic culture and made them into something specifically Indian. When the British first came, the same thing started to happen. Ashish Nandi says the early British felt physically at home in India. They allowed themselves to be absorbed like the Mughals before them.
I mean, during the first 100 years, the English marry freely the Indians. They live like Indians at their homes. Often they employed Brahmins to do their daily pujas. Most residents in India had a room where their women offered puja. I mean, you see very little of seclusion or very little of ghetto-like living during the first 70 or 80 years.
The first British settlers went native. Later that came to be considered one of the most cardinal of all sins. Kirkpatrick, resident in Hyderabad, had a Persian wife, dyed his fingers with henna, and behaved like a native and with great propriety. Mixed marriages were very much the done thing. Starting with Warren Hastings in the 1760s, a succession of good and honourable Englishmen restored order in the countryside, stamped out corruption, most of it British, and tried to work for the benefit of India and the Indians. With tact and respect for Hindu customs, they joined with reformist Indians to eliminate over time practices such as female infanticide and sati, where a wife throws herself, or is thrown, on the husband's funeral pyre. These Englishmen didn't look down their noses at India. They set about learning its languages and customs and translating its literature. And their names are part of today's India. They live on in its bricks and mortar. Warren Hastings, Mountstuart Elphinstone, Thomas Munro, and Charles Metcalfe.
Our dominion in India is by conquest. It is naturally disgusting to the inhabitants and can only be maintained by military force. It is our positive duty to render them justice, to respect and protect their rights, and to study their happiness.
And then in the 1830s, something changed. The process of absorption stopped, and the British withdrew into themselves. The new colonialists were evangelical Christians. Their doctrine was explicit and exclusive. The white man had a moral Christian duty to lead the black man out of darkness.
To have found a great people sunk in the lowest depths of slavery and superstition. To have so ruled them as to have made them desirous and capable of all the privileges of citizens would indeed be a title to glory all our own.
Thomas Babington Macaulay wanted to help Indians, but his interest was that of the man who effortlessly assumes that white is right in everything.
A single shelf of a good European library is worth the whole native literature of India and Arabia. There are no books on any subject which deserve to be compared to our own.
In the 1830s, Macaulay decided that education in India should henceforth follow the English model. Out went Vedic recitation classes, and in came English history, English literature, and Latin and Greek.
Shall we countenance at the public expense medical doctrines that would disgrace an English vet? Astronomy, which would move girls at an English boarding school to laughter? History full of kings 30 feet tall and reigns 30,000 years long? And geography made up of seas of treacle and rivers of butter?
India was now considered safe enough for the English Memsahib to join her mate. Mixed marriages were taboo. Indians were no longer looked on as equals or even interesting, but as part of the white man's burden. Poor Mrs. Moore and Adele Quested in Foster's A Passage to India. They never did understand the effortless racial snobbery of their fellow Sahibs and Mensahibs.
You know, Mr. Turton, when we get settled in, we look forward to meeting some of the Indians you come across socially as friends.
Well, as a matter of fact, we don't come across them socially. They're full of all the virtues, no doubt, but we don't.
East is East, Mrs. Moore. It's a question of culture. Mr. Turton, I'm longing to see something of the real India.
Fielding,
How's one to see the real India?
Try seeing Indians.
As if one could avoid seeing them.
Well, I've scarcely spoken to an Indian since we landed.
Lucky you.
There were exceptions. The many collectors who made it their business to know every corner and every one in their districts. Their love and knowledge of India was every bit as great as the racial arrogance of the majority of their countrymen. For once the British stopped allowing themselves to become Indianized and began to behave like Central Casting's caricature of colonial rulers, their impact was bound to be different from that of the Moguls. The consequences also. Most Indians agree that without the British presence, there probably wouldn't be a unified Indian state today. Khushwant Singh, one of India's leading journalists, sees two main legacies.
One, I think, the consciousness of one India was largely British concept. Here was an outside power which kept this country together and first time really brought in the entire nation under one. Then there was certain values that they instilled. I think the value of justice, the sense of justice and respect for human beings. They often abused it themselves, but the incidents were very few. By and large, most Indians would admit that they owe an enormous amount to the British.
The late Romesh Thapa, another prominent journalist, learned his Fabian socialism at university in England.
We are the children of colonialism, in the sense that so many of the concepts by which we lived and by which we have lived were borrowed concepts from British practice. We tried to apply them to our conditions. We modified them. We did all kinds of things. We made many serious errors.
Mrs. Y.G. Parthasarathy, headmistress of the Padma Seshadri Secondary School in Madras, thinks much of the British impact was disastrous. But on this point, she agrees with Khushwant Singh.
The one good legacy that the British did leave behind was the science. The scientific advancement that we have achieved today, we have to give credit to them. We wouldn't have had bridges and we wouldn't have had hospitals. At this level, we would have been like any other developing country if we didn't have the British with us for the past 300 years.
The British also had an extraordinary cultural impact, especially in Bengal. Take the case of Neeraj Chaudhary, now the grand old man of Indian writers. Chaudhary was born and raised in a small village called Kisorganj in what is now Bangladesh. In his father's hut were two shelves of books. On the top shelf, classics in Sanskrit and Bengali. On the bottom, the poems of Milton, the speeches of Edmund Burke, Shakespeare, Shelley and Wordsworth, Keats and Byron. Nowhere does the flame of 19th century romanticism burn more fiercely today than in the breast of the Bengali intellectual.
I am fondled by English life and civilization, not only by English life and literature, but what I have read of English life there.
All the ambivalence of the Raj and its legacy are contained within the extraordinary preface to Chaudhry's Autobiography of an Unknown Indian. To the memory of the British Empire in India, which conferred subjecthood on us but withheld citizenship, in which yet every one of us threw out the challenge, Civis Britannicus sum, because all that was good and living within us was made, shaped and quickened by the same British rule. It's not surprising that Chaudhry's been called the last defender of the British Empire. He cheerfully accepts it.
All political institutions have their bad side and their good side. If I had to tell my frank opinion about political institution, I would say today the worst political institution is American democracy. But I would not say therefore that democracy in itself is evil. So British Empire as empire was the best empire seen in the world after the Roman Empire. With for great faults, but even greater virtues.
But Chaudhry was never blind to the racial arrogance of the British in India. He could always distinguish between the benefits of British rule and his scorn for the behaviour of the British as colonial rulers.
two are utterly different, the institution and the human element. And human element, when it did not come into contact with us, was perfectly decent and had a sense of their obligation to India, what they have to do in India. As soon as they came in contact with Indians, the worst side of their character was always shown.
For many Indians, the impact of the British has been nothing short of disastrous.
Well, British legacy has been bad, you see, and that is why people fought for independence. They thwarted everything that was to be thwarted.
Jyoti Basu trained as a lawyer in London, became a Marxist there, and is now the chief minister of the Left Front government in West Bengal. Basu's view of the Raj is a blend of nationalism and Marxism.
Even when they spread education for a few, it was merely to run their empire and India. It was exploitation, and there was practically no democracy, no votes for us, and so on. So we can't have any good word to say about the British Empire or the British rule in India.
Many Indians are still convinced that the division of India in 1947 must be blamed directly on the British. The poet Uma Shankar Joshi in Ahmedabad.
They divided the Hindus and Muslims. They rather nurtured the animosities, because if you read history, Indian history, Hindus and Muslims were coming very close. Never were they so close as they were before the English arrived. And woe to us, they separated us. It was a satanic thing. They shouldn't have done this.
We're so used to imagining India as stricken by famine and poverty that we forget that it's a very fertile land, rich in natural resources. And back in the 18th century, it was even more so. The British East India Company thought they'd found a gold mine, and they were right. The impact of colonial rule on the Indian economy probably never bothered most of the British. They plundered and pillaged, exploited the countryside for its raw materials, and for their own benefit. And they also nipped a potential Indian industrial revolution in the bud.
The potentiality was there. It was aborted.
Dr. Ravinder Kumar is a historian and now director of the Nehru Memorial Library in Delhi.
The factory system of production had not been established in our country, but artisans working in villages, working in urban areas, or organized in what are called manufactories, were very much a part of the Indian landscape. And in a wide variety of consumer products, textile being the most famous of them, India was a great exporter of finished artisan goods.
The British imposed prohibitive import tariffs on Indian goods and reorganized the Indian economy into a protected market for English goods.
Now, this loss to our manufacturing industry, which took place really in the first half of the 19th century, was one of the most colossal negative features flowing from the establishment of colonial domination.
In the countryside, the British reformed property rights and tax collections with the laudable intention of ending the exploitation of the poor farmer by rapacious tax collectors. Unfortunately, in their misguided zeal to codify property rights, they ignored and disenfranchised all those whose titles had never been written down. And then they went one step further.
Most of the provinces, which are the troubled spots of the Indian economy today, they created a landed aristocracy, somewhat on the pattern of the British aristocracy. And the objective of this social experimentation was to create a class loyal to British rule and also to create the motors of economic development in our countryside.
But the zamindars weren't interested in developing agriculture. They regarded the land as their private property and milked it of revenue for all it was worth. The result is a state like Bihar, where the soil used to be so rich that you could throw a seed out of the window and it would grow. Today, Bihar still has rich topsoil, but it's one of the poorest and most backward of all Indian states.
some of the problems of poverty and overpopulation and all that goes with this really are a legacy of imperial rule in India.
And with poverty went an almost total failure to develop primary education in the countryside. Umashankar Joshi.
They sucked the very blood out of us. They left only 10% population literate. Only 10%, think of it, my friend. And it takes the life out of us to remove illiteracy now.
Those who were educated received the typical schooling of the English ruling class. Unfortunately, this tended to reinforce the natural preference of the Brahmins for a life of the mind rather than the toil of engineering or commerce. Mrs. Parthasati, the headmistress of Padma Seshadri Secondary School in Madras.
As far as education is concerned, after 300 years of British rule, we've been left with a very unfortunate legacy where our English education and the system of education has left only students fit to read, write English and to be clerks, glorified clerks, just pen pushers.
The new Indian elites were educated along the lines of the British public school to become gentlemen and all-rounders with a sense of duty and service to the less fortunate. Even today, India's elites tend to be drawn from places like the Doon School in the foothills of the Himalayas. So many old boys from the school are in positions of power in India that they're known as the Dosco Mafia. Doon is frequently criticised for turning out boys who are more Western than Indian. Nikhil Deogun, a school prefect, agrees with this criticism.
I feel we are losing, to a certain extent, our Indian culture in school. We know very little about India itself. We seem to know more about Shakespeare than we know about Rabindranath Tagore, which I feel is very wrong. We seem to forget that we are Indians first.
Suma Singh, a former deputy headmaster, only partially agrees.
A Doon school boy tends to be more Western than Indian. To that extent, this charge is valid. Whether it makes him into something other than an Indian is debatable. Because what exactly is an Indian? I think an Indian is somebody who thinks he's an Indian and doesn't matter which one of the regional languages, including English, he thinks in or what clothes he wears. I don't think that's so important.
English is the natural language for millions of Indians. Yet many of the same people who speak English as naturally as Hindi or Gujarati or whatever are adamant that the current emphasis on English as the medium of instruction, even in the remotest parts of the countryside, will bring little good to India. One of these critics is George Fernandes, a socialist and former member of the Indian Parliament.
On the contrary, I think it's a very bad thing. It has destroyed our education, it has destroyed our creative capabilities, it has destroyed our democratic system. It is destroying everything. And one has to go into rural Bihar, into the most interior rural Bihar. Some little thatched hut and somebody has put a board there, so-and-so convent school. Because everybody wants to go to a convent school, quote-unquote, convent.
With English medium.
Yeah. And you have people who don't know English, who are teaching English.
Kushwant Singh believes Indian leaders made a major mistake after independence in retaining English as a linked language.
As a nation building, you require at least a command of your own national language. And they didn't give preference to Hindi, they gave it to English.
One of the controversies that we had recently was whether the medium of instruction should be Bengali or English.
Aparna Sen is an actress, a film director, and now managing editor of a feminist magazine published in her native Calcutta.
Now, we all recognize that children should start out by being taught in their mother tongue. But you can't wipe out 200 years of history. And it's a very retrogressive step to completely, you know, not learn English or not be completely fluent in English, in fact. Because you've got to have communication with the rest of the world and the only language is English.
Nehru himself once said, "I cry
when I think that I cannot speak my own mother tongue as well as I can speak the English language. And perhaps the most subversive and long-term legacy of the British in India has been the alienation of the elite from other Indians and the loss of self-confidence of a people into whom it had been drummed that they were backward.
Regrettably, our psyches and our minds in India, especially of the elite, have not yet been totally decolonized.
That's Suleiman, Raja of Mahmudabad. Suleiman was educated at Cambridge University as an astrophysicist and returned somewhat reluctantly to manage the family's estates near Lucknow. He's now a member of the state parliament.
And I think this has an important effect on all sorts of things. And the attitude explains a lot of things, not just the sensitiveness to criticism or Western comments or whatever, but a lot of things within India. The way things are run, the way people behave, the social ills and so forth. Not all of them, of course, but I mean quite a substantial number.
Suleiman speaks English, Urdu and possibly a few more languages besides. But he also believes that the adoption of English has had unfortunate consequences.
In individuals, it has created people who are either rootless, you see, or who cannot relate to their own background and their own people generally, because they are a class to themselves, you know. They do not speak the language. After all, to come close to people and to understand them and to be able to articulate their aspirations. You have to have some way of communicating with them.
It's much harder to gauge the impact of India on the British. Other than nostalgia for a more glorious past, and the entry of a whole host of Indian words such as pajama, shawl, bungalow, into the English language, it's almost as if it had never happened. The British are also physically almost totally absent from India. There are very few links, personal or commercial. But to an Englishman, familiar reminders of an England that no longer exists abound throughout much of India. Time has stood still. India is the last great museum of the empire. Little things, red pillboxes and mail vans. Turning a corner in Calcutta to come face to face with a building that surely comes from Liverpool or Edinburgh. Billboards for products that were once household names in England. Horlicks, Bovril, Huntley and Palmer's biscuits. The incongruities. Lawyers peddling to court in 100-degree heat, wearing the long, heavy gowns of London's Inns of Court. Or the Calcutta Club, refusing an Indian entry because he isn't wearing a coat and tie.
The culture of the British gentleman, so to speak, was perfectly compatible with many elements of Brahminism. I don't think the Indian elites could have asked for a better fit in many respects. It is not an accident that the Indian traditional elites did exceedingly well under the colonial regime.
V.S. Naipaul says the British in India invented a fantasy called Englishness. He liked to quote this exchange between Adele and Ronnie in A Passage to India, and it does sum it up rather well.
Ronnie?
Yes?
To say something.
Yes?
Something important. Ronnie, I finally decided we're not going to be married.
You never said we would be married.
No.
But you were quite right to come out. It was a good idea.
Being awfully English about this, aren't we? I suppose that's all right.
As we are English. Yes, I suppose it is.
Maybe Indians are the last true Englishmen. a concept of Englishness as a desirable code of behaviour, sort of chivalry, tempered by a respect for the rule of law, a moral probity, as Kushwant Singh calls it.
A whole concept of justice is British. It may be superficial, but you quote, whenever you quote a man being impartial, you still quote the British officer. I mean, he gave judgments against his own people. Whatever he felt, whether he hated the country, when it came to doing his duty, he did it more conscientiously than the Indians who succeeded him. He did become a kind of paradigm of the colonial ruler. It's hard to believe he was much more liked than disliked.
The English impact on India is so full of paradox. The English language itself is blamed for undermining Indians' sense of their own identity. Yet English in India is no longer a foreign or a colonial language. Novelist Anita Desai.
Perhaps with the next generation, the Midnight's children, the post-47 children, English has become an Indian language. They've taken it over, they've changed its grammar, its intonation, even the meanings of the words.
And it's true. English really has infiltrated every level of Indian life. Any Hindi or Tamil or Malayalam conversation is peppered with English expressions, the tongue slipping in and out of the two languages with never a second thought. India has been profoundly anglicised, not westernised. But that's coming now, especially in Bombay and New Delhi. And of course, that's something rather different.
Biryani and Plum Pudding was written and produced by Julian Crandall-Hollick and Dean Capello. The production assistants in India were Rana Behel, Raja Chatterjee and Raj Shekharan. The actors were Akbar Zahir, William Radici, Philip Midwinter and Pradeep Krishan. The theme and incidental music were composed and performed by Shubha Shankaran. Consultants to this program were Philip Oldenburg of Columbia University and Ashish Nandi of the Center for the Study of Developing Societies. For more information about cassette copies of this series, please phone 1-800-854-TAPE during regular business hours. Passages to India is a production of IBA, Independent Broadcasting Associates, and is made possible with major grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities and the Rockefeller Foundation. Support for the national distribution of this program is provided by this and other national public radio member stations and by the NPR Cultural Program Fund. Contributors include the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation and the Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Fund, connecting artists and communities worldwide. I'm Deepika Roy.